that fishermen are totally being squeezed, not just on the ecological front of having less that they can even fish because there's less out there, but on this economic front. Monetization isn't necessarily the final solution, but it's a way to transition to at least being able to say we value these things. We can't just destroy them and think it's not going to have any ramification.
Welcome to Habitat, your weekly hour of conversations about how we live in our environment. I'm your host, Erica Butler. You're tuned to CKDU 88.1 FM or habitatradio.ca or rabble.ca/podcasts. This week on Habitat, I'm very happy to bring you an interview done by Robert Devitt, who is a great journalist with the Halifax Media Co-op. He sat down in a Halifax coffee shop with Linda Panozzo to talk about her new book, The Devil in the Deep Blue Sea, an investigation into the scapegoating of Canada's gray seal. And they had a really great conversation covering all the themes in Linda's book. Obviously, the main core example that she deals with is the issue of the seal cull. Not the seal hunt, but the seal cull. And then they get into all kinds of issues surrounding the fisheries and how we're managing things. It's a great interview, and we're bringing that to you very shortly. And then coming up in the last half hour, we're going to have another listen to an interview I did earlier in the year with Marc Jolicoeur from Vélo Québec, talking about the Route Verte and lessons we can learn from Quebec's Route Verte, their 5,000-kilometer bikeway throughout the province. Lessons that we can learn here in Nova Scotia to build our own blue route, which is happening. Anyway, so that's coming up. But first, Linda Panozzo and Robert Devitt.
Thank you very much for doing this, Linda. Like I said, it was a great book. Very, very interesting. Now, I'm such a layperson, like, there was an awful lot there to absorb.
Yeah, well, for sure. I mean, it's so complex. I mean, yeah. I think that's part of what motivated me to want to write the book, was because I feel like the issue has been so oversimplified in the media. It's versus gray seals versus the cod. It's this kind of very simplistic relationship that, you know, if you get rid of the seals, you get more cod. Like, it's, you know, and that's the way the media has portrayed it for the most part. For the last 4 or 5 years, for sure, since they've been talking about the gray seal explosion. So I wanted to engage that complexity, but at the same time, that makes it very difficult.
Like, if there's one overriding theme in there, it is exactly that complexity and how hard it is to know anything for sure in that world.
Absolutely. And, it's an invisible world.
It does leave you with a feeling like you want to just throw up your hands and say, well, what can we do at all? How can we even begin to think about managing fish stocks?
Well, I mean, I think even when we use that kind of language that we have to manage fish stocks, I think we've run into trouble, because I don't think we can manage a wild species, especially an invisible one, you know. And that's part of, again, that's part of what motivated me to write the book. There's all this uncertainty that nobody really wants to talk about. And I think there are economic reasons for that. I mean, one of the people I interviewed, Dean Bavington, who's fabulous. I mean, he's just such a fabulous thinker. He wrote this book that basically talks about how at the same time that we were creating swimming inventory in the ocean, you know, to satisfy economic needs, basically, we were also changing the science to satisfy those economics. So we weren't looking at cod anymore like a fish with a natural history, a life history, like the individual fish. But people still do that, of course. There are biologists who still do that. But fishery science has become very, very much one of managing these stocks.
There is also the political angle that tries to argue that complexity isn't there. If you wanted to illustrate that complexity, like, is there an example that comes to mind that really paints that picture?
Well, there's a graphic in the book that paints the picture for me.
The food chain,
the food web, unbelievable. I mean, that's a partial food web too. That there's no way it's not claiming to be the food web. It's partial. Yeah. When you look at that, that really struck me when I saw that photo, that graphic. And so you have that visual depiction of, you know, the complexity that exists. And then you have the fact of the matter is that you have scientific studies that are done about seals and cod and how they interact, and that's all that they include, is that, you know, how the seals and cod interact. They're called two species models.
Yeah.
You know, and these models are predominant. I mean, it's not like just one study was done. I mean, that's the predominant way of modeling. I mean, now there are changes taking place, like with ecosystem modeling, but that's new, and there are a lot of people that are not, you know, they're not familiar with how to do that, and, you know, so... So you have that. So that really showed me a lot. I mean, I think that just kind of struck me as like, wow. I mean, how could we say that this represents reality, a two-species model, when, you know, that's not even close to reality? And that's what a model is supposed to try to do. It's supposed to represent, as reductionist as it is, what's out there. And it doesn't. It's just a really expedient way of, you know, that, I think in that section I titled it, you know, Assumptions In, a Scapegoat Out. I mean, it's just... Sure, if you do it that way, it will make it look like the gray seals eat a lot of cod. I mean, it's just the way it's designed. So, you know, and then, of course, there's all the issue of the diet studies. It's not simple. It's not black and white. It's so complex. There's various ways of measuring the diet. There's disagreement among the scientific community about what they should be using.
What point in time?
Yeah.
Which seal, even apparently, like...
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, and the way they go about doing it. I mean, a wonderful example was given to me, or analogy was given to me by Don Bowen. And he is, you know, he is the seal, Sable Island seal expert. He's been studying them for 30 years. And he, at DFO, and he basically said, you know, the studies that they're using to measure seal diet now, that they're using to implicate the seals, it's like going into a McDonald's and saying that this is how people in Halifax eat. That's exactly what it's like. So they go to this one location where there's an aggregation of cod, they're finding that some seals are eating some of these big cod. And then they're extrapolating that to a much larger number. So there's so much complexity. Like, when you look at almost everything, every bit of information that has been oversimplified, and you actually look at it, it becomes complex.
Yeah. Then again, there are still a lot of people and a lot of fishers who argue that seals are the culprit, and also a lot of politicians.
Sure.
And it's especially the politicians I'm curious about. What is driving those folks in terms of pointing so with so much certainty to the seal?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that it's about votes. It may sound blatant, but I mean, even the whole Hay Island issue at the very beginning, where they're going to change the actual law to allow for commercial seal hunting on Hay Island in a protected area. You know, Howard Epstein was the chair of that Law Amendments Committee, and the Law Amendments Committee, after hearing all these submissions, decided not to change the law. Right? They were not going to change the law. That's what they felt from listening to all these experts, you know, many experts who came out. Then it went to the caucus of the NDP, and they said, no, this is a matter of votes. We don't want to lose the fishing vote, basically. They had just been elected. So that's, I mean, that's obvious, right? That's a very obvious thing. And then you can look at things like cod fishing. Since the moratorium was initially, you know, put in the early 1990s, I mean, there has been directed fishing for cod since then on a number of the stocks.
Yeah.
And that has always been against scientific advice. And so we have, and again, that's to placate, you know, people who want to fish for cod. So there are definitely political examples. Another political example would be where Gail Shea in 2009, basically in the summer of 2009, called for the a targeted removal of gray seals, and she wanted her department to ensure a targeted removal of gray seals. But this was before there was even any of this science compiled from St. Paul's Island and all of that, where they were saying that the seals were eating the big cod. So you have a lot of, you can see the politics in those, you know, in just those three examples. But I think politicians, the reason for that is largely because if you were to address the real reasons, I mean, one of the things I tried to do in the book was to go into the other hypotheses for why the fish stocks might not be doing well. Yeah, I mean, if you actually were to try to address those things, then you'd have to change the fishery. You would have to change the way it's executed. You'd have to change so many things about it, and they don't want to do that.
No, and you'd have to stop global warming. And
well, yes, you have to even address it first. I mean, you have to admit that it's happening.
Yeah, there's a lot there that we're doing, yeah.
That certainly don't help. Sure, but the gray seals are an easy target. The optics are terrible for the gray seals. You know,
yeah.
they have increased in population exponentially. That's changed now, but they have been, you know, through a chunk of the 1990s and early 2000s. And, you know, this has been their downfall in a way, because we can see them, the fishermen see them. They certainly do ruin their fishing gear. Like, I'm not disputing that there's a financial ramification for fishermen. I mean, if a seal ruins their gear, then obviously that's you know, a financial issue for them. But to jump from there and say, well, they're the reason for, you know, the cod non-recovery. I think also there's a real problem with codworm, right? There's that issue, and that is a marketing issue. I mean, you know, there's no question about that, but. I mean, marine mammals carry worms, and it's part of the natural cycle. It doesn't affect the cod. In fact, they found that these less marketable. But in fact,
but then you're also saying, but we probably shouldn't be fishing them at all at this time. So,
exactly.
You're tuned to CKDU 88.1 FM. HabitatRadio.ca and Rabble.ca/podcasts. We're listening to an interview done by Robert Devitt, Halifax Media Co-op journalist, with Linda Pinozzo, author of The Devil in the Deep Blue Sea, an investigation into the scapegoating of Canada's gray seal.
We have a really distorted and delusionary system in place right now.
Stay tuned for more from Linda Pinozzo and Robert Devitt.
When I read in the epilogue how you actually had to, how you did a freedom of information request, maybe you can talk about that a little bit. And not just that. I mean, the whole role of science in this, especially people associated with DFO. Or some people. So, like,
sure.
You know, not all of them. I understand that.
I mean, it was Ransom Myers and Jeff Hutchings who raised this whole issue of scientific control of scientific information back in, you know, around the time of the collapse. And Jeff Hutchings still talks about it. And he says he thinks things are worse today than they were back then. There's more control since Harper has been in power. Well, so what happened was when I started really delving into the book, I had done some research prior too for articles in The Coast and stuff like that. But when I actually started working on the book, I definitely had my list of initial questions anyway that I wanted to address to some DFO scientists. And when I approached some of them, they basically said I had to go through communications. So I did that, and this was probably in February of 2012, and then I heard nothing for like 2 months, you know, nothing. I sent in these questions, heard nothing. 2 months later, I finally hear from the Ottawa headquarters of communications, and they basically said that I needed to consolidate my requests because I did have requests to different people with different questions. So they wanted it all in one email, basically also just stating what my purposes were, what I was going to do with the information, where it was going to go, and what my deadline was. And so I said my deadline was, well, basically within 8 months, because I had to have it done by December, the manuscript. So 5 months go by. And so now we're talking September, okay? And I had a deadline of December.
Yeah, you must be getting a little nervous.
Yeah, I mean, in the meantime, I'm doing other research. I'm trying to find the information in any way I can. I'm reading studies. I'm still doing the work for the book. But there were certain people. Don Bowen was one of them. And he was so key to the book in so many ways, because he is the scientist at DFO who's been studying these seals on Sable Island for 30 years. He knows so much. So I just got frustrated not hearing anything after 5 months, and so I put in a Freedom of Information request. I got back, basically in November, I got back 320 pages of emails. Now, a lot of those were, you know, duplicates, because there were 18 people at in communications, right, who were somehow copied or involved in my, you know, so here I am. I'm thinking nothing's going on. I'm thinking nobody is responding. Yeah. They're just kind of like my files on
there?
The side.
Yeah.
Yeah. And meanwhile, like, there's so much going on with these questions. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I don't want to go into all, it is all listed in the book, all the different things that I did find. They're in the epilogue. Interesting things about the control of information, about scientists being given media lines, about some censorship, about not being given permission to speak to certain people. I did finally get a chance to speak to Don Bowen. It was the beginning of December. And, you know, it actually worked in my favor, because by then I knew so much more information than what I knew in February. So I'm actually grateful in that sense, because I was able to ask him the very key questions that I probably wouldn't have been able to, you know, I didn't know at the time in February. But anyway, that's, so yeah, science, you know, I mean, the thing is that if you control the communication of science, you do also control the science. And, you know, Daniel Pauly, who's like a fantastic, he's one of the most prolific fishery scientists in the world. He's at UBC. Only a really interesting, I mean, he described it in a very interesting way. He basically said that, you know, it's not that the science that comes out, like each individual study, is wrong. What happens is, you know, the policy gets created at the top, you know, probably in conjunction with the fishing industry. Like, let's look at the gray seals, let's look at the cod worm, let's look at all these, they want all these things looked at. Let's look at the, you know,
they set the agenda.
Those things get looked at, because they're not looking at trawling, they're not looking at the effects of climate change, not really, and they're not looking at acidification. I mean, there's like one scientist who might be working on these things, but not the concerted effort that happens like with gray seals. Okay, so the policy gets set at the top, and then what they do is the funding, you know, scientists, it trickles down, and scientists can get so much funding for this and funding for that, and so you just get all this funding going to this one area of gray seals. I mean, the studies are abounding on that, on the website. I mean, you can find so many studies. And so you have all this information, and so it's like the science is not wrong, but that's how it becomes distorted, because you have this bulk of information.
It's the scope of the science.
Yeah, you have all this information about one thing.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so that's why when they did this, you know, where they looked at these various other hypotheses, there are half a dozen other hypotheses alternative to the gray seal hypothesis. Almost most of those things had no data, little data, not no data, because it wasn't even included if it had no data. But if it had any data whatsoever, it was included as a hypothesis. But because they hardly spent any time looking at any of those things, the data was very minuscule.
And therefore, there
was no weight to it. So, you know, that's the thing. They look at. Twice it was described to me by both Don Bowen and Daniel Pauly. It's like looking for looking for a key under a street lamp. You know, looking for something where the light is being shone the brightest. So it's distorted.
Okay. Mm-hmm. A little bit about, you already brought him up, this Bavington guy, and that it's like we're all trapped into a particular process. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, historically, he talks about how there would have been local, you know, depletions of stocks. You know, he doesn't romanticize sort of, you know, historically what would have happened in these fishing communities. I mean, sure, they might have overfished something, but then they would have switched to something else, you know, and then allowed that to come back. So there certainly would have been local depletions. But what happens now is because there's so much invested in a certain stock, a certain fish species or whatever, you can't switch. You can't just go back and forth. You have to it's like you're ramped up to just basically get what you can get out of it.
Yeah.
And so that's what happens now. And that's what we've seen, right? We've seen that.
And the whole language around that has changed.
The language, yeah. So, you know, and fisheries, the whole idea of fisheries management of a stock and having a maximum sustainable yield and, you know, all of those things is... it's geared towards satisfying, you know, the investment and the need for profit, basically. So you don't, you're not looking at the, you know, the ecological. One of the things I wanted to bring up in the book was that, you know, our system doesn't look at values, ecological services. It doesn't look at the intrinsic value of any animal species. We just look at what we can get by selling them, you know, the market value. That's the only value.
You mean as opposed to that much more subtle.
Analysis. All of those other things are, you know, ecosystem services are extremely valuable to us. I mean, think of things like carbon sequestration or, you know, the provision of biodiversity. I mean, all these different things that we don't put a dollar sign to them. And I'm not saying that would be necessarily putting a dollar sign. Monetization isn't necessarily the final solution, but it's a way to transition to at least being able to say we value these things. We can't just destroy them and think it's not going to have any ramification, because we know that they have ecological value.
The thing that struck me when you look at it from a fisherman's perspective, a fisher's perspective, like, this is really something that they have to go along with, or they will simply vanish. This whole notion of thinking in those terms of a yield.
I think that's a big issue that very little has been really looked into in Nova Scotia, the ITQ system, the informal ITQ system.
Yeah.
It's an area that really should be explored more. I mean, I wish I could have explored it more, but I was just really trying to show that the fishermen are totally being squeezed, not just on the ecological front of having less that they can even fish because there's less out there, but on this economic front, and that, you know, Canada is such a big country, and we forget that there's this other coast, you know, where there's the DFO also functions on the west coast, where this ITQ system is completely entrenched there now. And you have, that's a place where anybody can own fish stock, fish quota. You don't have to be a fisherman. You don't have to have a license. I mean, anyone, a lawyer, can own fish quota. I mean, we just don't really hear about that here.
No.
Like, because it's almost like it's another country, you know, because it's so far away. It's an area, the fisheries is, it's really complex, right? I mean, there's so many different stocks. There's so many different ways of catching those fish. The execution of the fishery is complicated. So most people don't really know that much about it. They just, there's a lobster boat. There's whatever.
Yeah.
There's a dragger out there. Like, they just don't really understand the policy part. And the policy part right now that's in place is protecting, to some degree, is protecting the inshore fishermen. He can still eke out a living, some, not all of them, but some of them. And if those policies change, like the fleet separation, which is, I think they were worried about that last year. I don't know if you remember, there was a report that came out. I remember
there was a Tory senator or something who said something wild.
I mean, most people reading that don't even really so what's the big deal, you know? But it is a big deal, because you can end up with people who are not fishermen, who are not licensed fishermen, owning quota.
Yeah.
And you can end up with people
like Clearwater, actually, which would be really
there is concentration already happening.
Right? Like,
but it's just, there's so little information out there on it. It's not public information.
It's not juicy, right? Like,
it's not juicy.
And it's far away.
You're listening to an interview with Linda Panozzo, conducted by Robert Devitt of the Halifax Media Co-op. Linda Panozzo's new book is The Devil in the Deep Blue Sea, an investigation into the scapegoating of Canada's gray seal. This is Habitat, conversations about how we live in our environment. I'm your host, Erica Butler. Coming up, we're going to hear part 3 of the interview with Robert Devitt and Linda Panozzo. And then, in the last half hour of the show, we'll go to an interview with Marc Jolicoeur of Vélo Québec to find out what Nova Scotia can learn from Quebec's amazing 5,000-kilometer route verte.
thing is that if you control the communication of science, you do also control the science.
Stay tuned for more from Linda Pinozzo and Robert Devert as they tackle potential solutions to the issues we have with our fisheries system.
Okay, now let's get back then to Bavington, because I was reading, like, Bavington sort of, and you seem to agree, sort of raised that issue that in the olden days, things were looked at in a smarter way, in many ways. I think there's also this little piece about, you know, native people who respect and all that, and it's all true. But that people, like, how do you actually foster a change like that in this in this world?
Well, I think about that every day.
Okay.
Honestly, I mean, I have a 10-year-old daughter, so I think, what is the future going to be like for her? I think that it has to happen on so many different fronts. I don't think there's one solution. It would be great if there was, but I mean, I think there has to be, you know, the move away from a revisioning of our economic system. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. It works for the elite, but it doesn't work for the majority of people, and it doesn't work for the planet. So that has to be gotten rid of somehow. How does that happen? It's a huge question. We have to, I mean, at the same time that we're reimagining our relationship with nature, you know, where we are trying, we try to, you know, instill maybe in our kids and in each other a sense of, you know, that everything out there has a place, and it has, it should be respected. And I think that's why I brought in the worldview of the indigenous people, because there is, and there always has been, a very deep respect for the natural world. And yes, they have used the natural world, there's no question, but the reality is that there's been a respect for it, which we don't have anymore. And, you know, so on the one hand, the worldview is really important, because you won't, I don't think we're going to make the changes that have to be made, you know, in terms of the economic system, unless there is a change in our worldview, in the way we imagine the world, in our relationship within it, you know. But at the same time, I wanted to bring in this other stuff about, you know, valuing ecosystem services and putting values on things that we currently ignore completely in our economic system. So, I mean, there's a lot of groups all over the world working on that. I mean, I did some work with GPI Atlantic, and that's just one group that's been doing that. But there's groups everywhere, you know, and that are trying to replace the GDP, the importance of the GDP in our economic system, because everything right now is based on GDP. If you look at fisheries, when they talk about the success in the fisheries, they're just looking at GDP. They're just looking at, you know, the value of the landings. You know, that's all they look at, commercial value. They're not looking at, well, what did they leave behind? How did they leave the ocean substrate? You know, they don't look at any of that. That's ignored. But that affects the next generations of fish. So we have a really distorted and delusionary system in place right now. And so we do have to change. There has to be a shift economically. It's going to take enlightened leadership. I mean, is that possible? Are there enlightened leaders out there? Oh, it's really, you know, it's difficult. But I mean, the only way, I mean, you see things like, you know, marine protected areas, and there's proof that marine protected areas work. There are places in the world where they've been put in place, and the fisheries landings improve in, you know, in the areas surrounding these marine protected areas. So they actually work, but it takes enlightened leadership. It takes politicians who are willing to sort of see, not just respond to, you know, immediate profit-driven industrial requests, or, you know, that's probably not the right word.
But I know what you mean.
But, you know, like, right now, that's all they basically respond to. It's very immediate. It's short-term. No one's thinking long-term. I mean, there's so many things that need to change. Our political system needs to change. Our electoral system needs to change. I mean, I didn't go into that in the book, but it does, because right now we don't have an electoral system that works properly.
See,
if you interview a fisheries scientist like Daniel Pauly or probably Jeff Hutchings, they'll all come up with very practical, they will come up with very practical
pragmatic
things that
yeah.
could happen in the fisheries right now.
Yeah.
About about the different methods that should be used. I mean, certain things should be banned, right? I mean, there should be no trawling.
There's no doubt about that.
Certain stocks should not be fished. Bycatch has to be dealt with. They don't deal with that. Bycatch has been ignored. So we have all of these things that need to be looked at, for sure. So those are very pragmatic things within the fishery that have to be addressed. But in terms of changing the economic system,
that's way too large. Actually, that's not a fair question for this
interview. It's a fair question, but it's a hard one to answer.
But I did want to, sort of highlight this, things you say in that last chapter, because I think it's very important that also sort of brings home the point that this book is not really about seals, right?
It's not really. I mean, the seals and the cod, and I say it in my author's note, it represents how everything has gone askew. It's like an object lesson in what we've done wrong. And so that's how I see it. I see it as an example to illustrate a lot of other things.
You're tuned to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and rabble.ca/podcasts. Coming up next, the final part of the interview with Linda Panozzo and Robert Devitt. Linda Panozzo's new book, The Devil in the Deep Blue Sea, an investigation into the scapegoating of Canada's gray seal. In this last segment, Linda and Robert will chat about the issues around the seal cull and the politics of that, and how the seal hunt also plays into that, and the sensitivity of the issue in Atlantic Canada. Linda has some great stories. That's coming up next, and then in the last half hour, we're going to revisit an interview with Marc Jolicoeur of Vélo Québec, all about the 5,000-kilometer Route Verte. Stay tuned.
Not about the seal hunt.
No.
The seal hunt is talked about in the book as context, because it is such a it has been so polarizing, the seal hunt.
That's going to be my last question, actually.
Been so polarizing, and that polarization in the seal hunt has affected the discussion in the seal call, because it's seals. So yes, it's a very polarizing issue, and I approached the Ecology Action Center to ask them about their position on the seal cull, and they made it very clear they're not against the seal hunt. Even though I wasn't asking them about the seal hunt, I was asking them about the seal cull. It is so polarizing, and I found that right from the start, even in doing the research, that was a challenge for me, because everybody wanted to know, well, what side are you on with the seal hunt? And so as soon as they can, peg you as being on one side or the other, then that either they want to talk to you or they don't. I mean,
very... Yeah, even if they talk to you, they'll have you stereotyped.
Absolutely. And I think that way of looking at things that way, like this polarization of, well, you're either with the sealer or the fisher or you're with the seals, it's a false dichotomy. That was another reason why, and I've seen it over and over again. I've lived in resource-based, communities for a lot of my life. Northern Ontario near Temagami with the forest industry and the white pine forest being clear cut. I mean, the whole time, it was always the logger, you were with the logger or you were for the trees, but the thing is, forestry and the fisheries and all of these different mining, they all exist within our economic system. And it's the economic system nobody's talking about. I mean, the fisher and the logger and the forester and the miner, I mean, they're all pawns in a way. They're all exploited just like everything else.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's why I wrote that last chapter.
Yeah.
That shows how the fishermen are being squeezed, because they are. And I don't blame them for scapegoating the gray seal, because what else can they blame?
Yeah.
They've been pushed to the wall. Yeah. Oh,
Long time before this, from the National Parks Project compilation. Coming up next on Habitat, we're going to hear from Marc Jolicoeur from Vélo Québec, talking about the 5,000 kilometer Route Verte in Quebec. And then, but first I do want to take a moment to say thank you to Habitat listeners for reaching into your pockets and donating to support the station during the funding drive this year. Your help is very much appreciated. Thank you very much. You're listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and rabble.ca/podcasts. Marc Jolicoeur is a research coordinator with Vélo Québec. He was recently in Nova Scotia to present workshops on developing successful bikeway networks. His timing was great because the province of Nova Scotia has just announced they will take the lead on implementing a blue route for Nova Scotia, a bikeway network that will connect communities across the province. The blue route concept is modeled directly after the Route Verte, the incredible 4,000-kilometer network in Quebec that has been championed by Vélo Québec. Marc Jolicoeur, thanks for joining us on Habitat.
You're welcome.
Now, you live in Montreal and commute to work by bicycle. I have to start out by asking you, I have found that in my visits to Montreal, I've been so impressed by the ease at which I can cycle around, even as someone who's from away, who doesn't know the streets and the shortcuts. Has cycling always been that great in Montreal?
Oh, no, not at all. If you go back 20 years ago, it was not very pleasant to cycle on most streets. We did have, since quite some time, one north-south axis that is composed mostly of cycle tracks, so you are separated from traffic. But otherwise, as soon as you ventured out of that major axis, it was much more difficult.
Yeah. So there's been a lot of improvements in the last 20 years.
Oh, I would say it has, in the last 5 years, it has been tremendous because we have more and more traffic calming and more bike lanes all over the place in the central district.
Mm. And so that's just political will, you would say, in the last 5 years that's making that happen? Or?
Yes, it was political will on one side and also, the fact that the transportation plan and the general master plan of the city both recognized walking and cycling as full right modes of transportation.
Mm. Cool. So there's hope for Halifax. Now, the Route Verte, of course, is not just in Montreal. It runs all over the province.
Well, it's mostly out of Montreal because it's now even 5,000 kilometers long. We just reached the 5,000 kilometer bar.
Oh, really?
Yes, and it's mostly on either on rail trails. We have roughly 2,000 kilometers of bike paths, most of them on abandoned railroad beds, and 3,000 kilometers on roads, mostly on Ministry of Transportation highways that have paved shoulders or very low traffic volumes.
Okay, so some of it is like designated roads where you've said this is okay for cycling because we have a wide enough paved shoulder, or there's just so little traffic that it's safe for cycling.
Yes.
Cool. How long has Vélo Québec been working on the Route Verte?
Since 1995, we started the project at that time. There was roughly 1,000 kilometers of bits and pieces all across the province at that time. And we had that plan since, we had presented back in 1992 a plan for an integrated network. And we did come to an agreement with the government in 1995 on a more basic plan, but that was successful.
Mm-hmm. Now, where did the idea come from to integrate all these you know, disparate separate little bike paths around the province and sort of make it one large network that people could, you know, go to the website and look up, you know, how I can bike from here to the Gas Bay or something?
Well, when I was in Nova Scotia last week, I kept saying, people, well, we just stole ideas to others, and we hope that we steal our ideas. Basically, we looked at similar networks in Europe, for instance, in the Netherlands, in Denmark, in UK. They have these networks in UK with the National Cycle Network. They now have, I think, over 10,000 miles of routes that are assigned. So we modeled the develop on all these major networks.
When people cycle along the route Vert, there's traffic signs and sort of signs pointing you in the direction of which way to go, similar to what motorists would see on highways, but this time it's for cyclists.
Yes, exactly. And this is something very important, because part of the network are on bike path, and then you come to a road and it follows on the road. And so you need to have those turn-by-turn signs that tell you, well, you're still on the route vert. And we do have also more and more destination signs where we say that the next city will be in 15 kilometers, or that if you go out of route vert and make it right, well, in 2 kilometers you will be at that village, or
right, so people know where they're at when they're cycling.
Exactly. Yeah. That's something very important.
Yeah. Now, is the focus of the route Vert on touring cyclists?
Well, the idea behind the network was cycle touring, but we knew in the first place that it would also be a very interesting local facility.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the users, and it's the same on roads, when you have a very touristic road, most of the users are still local people going on that route belt. And it did have a tremendous impact in many small communities and medium-sized communities. Places like Victoriaville, maybe 30,000 inhabitants. There are hundreds of people walking and cycling on the bike path that crosses downtown and goes by two or three retirement homes. So it's very, very popular locally for recreation, but also for transportation. When it's on your way to school or to work, people are also using it for these purposes.
Now, you were recently in Nova Scotia to deliver some workshops. Mm-hmm. Did you ride while you were here?
I didn't have the chance to ride. I didn't walk a lot.
And, okay.
I did some tours, guided tours by bus, and but I saw quite a few facilities.
Okay. So what did you think of the bike infrastructure that you saw here?
Well, it's you are basically starting, I would say, but there's a huge potential because in Halifax, for instance, in all the peninsula, the distances are not that long. And even from the Dartmouth side, it's relatively easy to cross to the other side. I do understand that the bridge will be closed at some point for repairs, but still you have that ferry, and there could be much more service for our cyclists. And I'm sure there's a tremendous potential both in Halifax and in the smaller communities where you do have lots of small rural roads to go by.
Part of your work with Velo Quebec was in authoring the Planning and Design for Pedestrians and Cyclists, the handbook.
Mm-hmm.
This is something I've always wondered about bike infrastructure, that I find it looks so different everywhere you go in Canada. Right, the signs and the infrastructure for motor vehicles seem pretty standard, although there's sometimes differences. But for bikes, there seems to be a lot of variety as you move around the country. Is this because we don't have national standards or accepted practices for bike infrastructure and what we do with bikes?
I wouldn't say that. I think it's much more because we are mostly in the infancy of cycling infrastructure. Even in Montreal, as I said, less than, well, 10 years ago, we had almost no bike lanes, only a few cycle tracks that were very popular because they were on a direct route for students going to two or three universities downtown. But otherwise, we had few facilities and just from the same kind. And it's a bit the same in other cities. For example, Edmonton and Calgary have wonderful bike path networks, but all of these are on, well, along rivers and in parks. They have very few facilities on street. They are just starting these now. And if you go in Vancouver, it's a bit the opposite. They have mostly what they call local street bikeways, which are streets that are very convenient and fast for cyclists and pedestrians, but inconvenient for cars because you cannot cross arterials. You are forced to make a right turn. So it's they have a different type of network, but all of these could apply in all of the cities I just mentioned. It's just that each city has developed what was easiest for them.
Right, so there are standards, but each city is sort of concentrating on different things.
Exactly.
Yeah. Is something like Vélo-Québec's the handbook that you wrote, Planning and Design for Pedestrians and Cyclists, is that something that you traffic engineers in Quebec have adopted, or is it or does it go, even go beyond Quebec?
Yes, our aim was to make that book available for all Canadian engineers and planners and landscape architects, so that they would have all these basic notions about planning for pedestrians and cyclists, because there are very little literature on these things. We have small chapters and standards or in road guidelines that are for pedestrians or cyclists, but very few of these things, and usually quite conservative because all the standards were first written back in the mostly 1950s, and they were at that time for highways and freeways. So they didn't concentrate at all on other issues as pedestrians or cyclists.
You guys have been working on the Route Vert for 20 years, and of course you made amazing progress. I mean, going from 1,000 kilometers of sort of disconnected bikeways to now 5,000 kilometers of a connected network. But what were the main challenges, would you say? Like, what should we in Nova Scotia be looking out for?
Well, when the project started, we were hired by the government to coordinate the development of that project because it's something that is it's quite a task to coordinate because, of course, when you say that there's even a small funding program, the funding program was funding 25% of the infrastructure. Still, some municipalities will say, "Well, I have this project," and they don't necessarily care if it does connect with the neighbor municipalities, and it's the same at the regional level. So, we asked for regional planning, but we oversaw that the planning in two adjacent regions wouldn't connect. So in most instances, it was relatively easy, but in we had quite a few places where we had to have long discussions, and even now we have quite near from Montreal. We are having meetings today to see what solution we can come to.
So you're basically I mean, I guess one of the big challenges is coordinating the different interests, because of course the bikeways are not all just being built by the government of Quebec. It's different communities, different towns, and municipalities that are also putting in the work along the route.
Oh yes, I would say that everything that is off-road is being built by municipalities. with a few exceptions. There are a few short paths in provincial parks, but otherwise, what is off-road is built by municipalities. And the same applies to roughly one-third of what is on-road, that is on municipal roads. So, of course, we do have, I think, over 200 municipalities that are involved in the project. So that's a challenge to coordinate all of this and to make sure that people agree on one route. We didn't want to have what we call the zipper in the first place and that the roadmap goes everywhere. It might branch in the future and get you everywhere, but we wanted to have a backbone in the first place and to have something that a major collector route for cyclists in the first place that would go through the major towns and that would go through the major points of interest.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any advice for Nova Scotians as we start out on our process of building our own blue route modeled after the route Vert?
Well, make sure that your first steps are successes, because there's nothing worse than to build something that is not used, because then people say, well, it's of no use. It and that can happen when you have some easy stretch, but that they are not connected to population. So starting near with bike paths or on-road facilities that are near the largest towns is always successful because people want to cycle there. There's a desire to be outside, and we have a nice winter, but in the spring everybody wants to go out, so cycling becomes very popular. So start with successful places and then link these together.
Hmm. Right.
And also never forget maintenance. So when you build something, it's sometimes we had problems with places where they did build very nice facilities, but that were maybe a bit over their maintenance capacity. So after a few years, when it gets almost abandoned, it's not worth building these facilities. You should build something that will last.
Right. Yeah. There needs to be some upkeep in order to keep it functional.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And it all goes together. If you have a bike path that is very attractive and where you have plenty of people going, then it's quite easy to get the budget to maintain these. And then you will need to have some type of financing program that will help the smaller municipalities with their duties. In Quebec, for the Route Verte, the ministry does finance, the transportation ministry did finance 25% of bike paths and on-road facilities that were part of Route Verte, but they do finance 50% of the maintenance.
So there's a secured funding for that.
Yes. And this is quite small. It's less than $3 million a year for a province with 8 million inhabitants. It's if you compare that to the transportation budget, it's almost nothing.
What do we stand to gain? You know, what will the benefits be if we can manage to develop this blue route that can connect communities?
Well, plenty of them. First of all, of course, it's a tourist network, so it will help tourist accommodations and attractions to have a bit more clients. In Quebec, we saw that it did help in some smaller places, in the villages and small towns that had a hard time with tourism. It kind of revived and started back some hope in these places because it was almost dead. And now with the cyclists that came in, well, some people started to open bed and breakfast and things like that. So it does help. It doesn't make it all by itself, but it's something that can help bring back tourists.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are plenty of benefits for health because you have these nice facilities that people will use locally, because quite often people are not willing to cycle because they are afraid of the traffic and they don't have any place where to cycle except then on roads. So that's another benefit.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Mark Joliker.
Thank you.
Yeah. You've been listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and rabble.ca/podcasts. Got feedback on the show? Call the CKDU feedback line at 494-8041 or email habitat@ckdu.ca or check us out on Twitter at Habitat Radio. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening.